Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. And before we meet our panel, let's have a look at the front pages of the papers and what there is off the front pages of the papers today. There's a great sense of action. It's almost as if the powers that be realise that people are feeling a sense of torpor, so there's lots of action happening. Sunday Independent, Housing Minister James Brown, to call in, quotes, maverick outsider to help tackle housing crisis. So they're obviously looking to Clint Eastwood or somebody like that. And he's setting up a strategic housing activation office. It's going to be external. It's going to be people who are experienced at kicking open those doors to get that delivery. More action on the front of the Sunday Times. Street crime is number one target, says top Dublin Garda. The new head of policing for Dublin has vowed to take a more robust approach to street crime, increase high visibility policing, crack down on crime, a pro-arrest policy where necessary to keep the capital safer. This is Assistant Commissioner Paul Cleary, who took over in Dublin shortly before Christmas. I generally believe that greater visibility will lead to a safer city, he says. And then more action on the front of the Mail. Harris Island triple lock on troops in weeks. And indeed, that story is on the front of a couple of other papers as well. So proposals to amend Ireland's triple lock on neutrality that will remove the UN veto on deploying defence forces, peacekeepers on overseas missions will be brought to Cabinet within weeks, Taoiseach Simon Harris told the Irish Mail on Sunday. The Business Post have a poll, and what they're pulling out of it is that 25% of Fianna Fáil voters switch over collapse of housing targets. Supporters say they would not have voted for the party if data was out before election. And be that as it may, the actual state of the parties in that poll does not reflect that finding at all. But look, we'll come back to that. And then the Sunday World is leading with a really awful story about a woman's account of horrific torture at the hands of her partner, like ripped out her thumbnail with pliers, poured boiling water on her. It was a 3-day torture ordeal. Really is awful story. And then the Sunday Mirror, Brian Dowling hired private investigators to nab internet trolls for hate crimes against his family. Okay, so our panel, who will analyse the papers for us and look at what mattered last week and what's going to matter next week, Louise Byrne, political correspondent with the Irish Daily Mirror, David Quinn, columnist with the Sunday Independent, Dr. Graham Finlay, Assistant Professor of Politics and International Relations at UCD, and Louise Bayliss is co-founder of Spark and Head of Social Justice and Policy at the St. Vincent de Paul. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
David, obviously, people all over the world are praying for Pope Francis, and I'm sure everyone hopes he'd be back in the Vatican for prayers next Sunday. But I suppose the reality is that, as it's reflected in a piece in the Sunday Times today, inside the real life conclave, that there's probably a lot of political activity going on around the Vatican now. And I presume the future of the Catholic Church is kind of up for grabs, is it?
Yes. I mean, he's 88 years of age and he's been sick for quite some time. And even if he comes out of hospital this time, when you're that old and you're in that kind of poor health, you've got to assume that could be another episode, and I'd be surprised if, at least in the next few months, and certainly by the end of the year, we don't have a new pope.
So you're alluding to him stepping down? Yeah, I know the Vatican are coming out saying, please stop these rumours and everything, but there seems to be an indication that he had not quite been setting his affairs in order, but trying to tie up his work recently, and there's a sense that he might feel, if he's not able to go on, he might step down.
Yes, I mean, he has never ruled out the possibility of stepping down if he figured that he couldn't do the job properly anymore. I mean, he was actually in Asia just a few months ago. He did a multi-country tour that included places like Papua New Guinea, which is pretty good going for a fellow who's 88 years of age and in poor health and in a wheelchair. So he has great will and determination to keep going. But I suppose there comes a point at which your body simply won't do it. And particularly if he ends up, you know, needing semi-permanent or permanent medical care. I mean, we can think of our own parents when they got to that age. And they just become more or less housebound. And I think if he gets to that point, he could well step down. But even
and presumably
if he does,
this would have been kind of unheard of before. But did Benedict change the precedent on the idea of a pope stepping down?
Well, he did, of course. I mean, he stepped down in 2013 because he figured that he just wasn't mentally or physically up to it anymore. I mean, he had got very old at that point. I mean, he lived for years longer because he was well looked after. But I think as well, I mean, John Paul II had been so sick for so long and wheelchair bound for so long that probably people are thinking it's no good having a pope in that state, you know, for so long as that. And you see, people live obviously much longer than they used to. And people can live in ill health for a long time. And also the papacy is an awful lot more visible than it used to be. So it's more obvious when somebody is very sick. I mean, if you even look at politics, like Franklin Delano Roosevelt was sick for a long time towards the end of his presidency and arguably should not have been re-elected to a fourth term. But it was possible to hide a person's ill health, you know, years ago. But you can't do that now.
Was there a sense as well, we'll move on. No, but there was a sense as well, though, with Benedict still alive and still there and kind of living over the hill, wasn't he? There was a sense of there being two popes.
Yes, I mean, it does make things awkward. So that's one of the arguments in favour of not retiring. But I guess when you're 88 and in poor health, then, you know, the chances are you're not going to be there for 10 years.
No, look, on that, OK, in one sense, I think like some people were practically writing the poor man off last night. Mm. Pope Francis has expressed confidence in his treatment. This is today in a message published in place of his weekly Angelus prayer as he spent a 10th day in hospital. And he says, I'm confidently continuing my hospitalisation at the Gemelli Hospital, carrying on with the necessary treatment. And rest is also part of the therapy, he said in the message that Vatican sources said that was written in the past few days. OK, but we did hear yesterday that he had some kind of event yesterday morning. But then he did seem to be sitting out of the bed in a chair and alert for the rest of the day. So tell me then a bit, I'll come to the rest of you in a minute, guys, but tell me a bit, David, about the political machinations that are likely to happen now. So just a lot of people will be turning their minds to this fresh again. Is there a view, I know it's not as simple as this, but is there a view that Francis was a kind of a liberal force in the church, and will there now be a battle between to continue that kind of liberalism or for the more conservative elements within the cardinalship to want to wrest back control of the church?
Yeah, well, he was liberal-ish, I suppose you'd say. I mean, what's really made the next conclave extremely unpredictable is that he has chosen people as cardinals who would not normally have been chosen. So the thing which would have happened in the past, if you were, let's say, Archbishop of Milan, you were automatically going to become a cardinal. So he's torn all that up. And he has made people cardinals in places like, you know, Myanmar and Tonga and Mongolia, places, you know, with tiny Catholic congregations. So this makes
The church is perhaps growing or thriving
places,
more than it might be in the traditional places.
Yeah, and I think he's picked one in Singapore as well. But it makes the, you know, predicting what will come out of the next conclave extremely unpredictable. I'd say most of these cardinals don't know each other because they don't actually meet all that often.
Okay.
And again, in the past, if it was going to be the Archbishop of Milan, all the other cardinals would know him. But you mightn't necessarily know the guy from Tonga or Myanmar, and they mightn't even know each other all that much. So I think when they go into conclave, they're going to be kind of looking at each other. And I think it's kind of like going to be a fairly open horse race.
Okay. Graham, in terms of your brief of politics and international affairs, does this matter as much as it used to?
I think it matters more, arguably. And actually, I was struck by how 110 of the 138 cardinals who are eligible to vote were appointed by Francis. So the question is how ideological they are. But no, I mean, just recently, J.D. Vance, who is a Catholic convert, put out the idea that in response to concerns about mass deportations in the United States, that, you know, there's an order of loves where we first have compassion for our family, then our neighbor, then our community, then our fellow citizens, and then maybe people beyond that. And Pope Francis may be physically, you know, feeble right now, but he's spiritually strong. And he sent a very, very interesting letter to the Catholic bishops of the United States saying that's not how it works. The dignity which is in every human being, which Christ preaches for us to respect and to support, means that these kinds of mass deportations are not compatible with Catholic teaching. So I mean, as a moral and political philosopher, this is my Super Bowl. But, actual presence, I think, in, you know, liberal or otherwise in the world has really enhanced, I think, the discussions which involve the doctrines of the Catholic Church.
Okay. And fascinating that the Pope is involved in a theological argument with J.D. Vance.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's, you know, again, like I said, this is great for us moral and political philosophers. But you know, there's a very, very serious issue at the heart of it, not just how do we treat the stranger, how do we, you know, comfort the stranger, who is my neighbor, but, you know, real concrete questions of international policy. It frequently comes up in international distributive justice. You know, what should we do about, you know, foreign aid? Also in the news, what do we do about the global poverty? Yeah. And Pope Francis has really given a real support to that, and also sustainability in terms of his focus on the environment. Yeah. So I think there's
so
more.
So David, he's been quite a political pope in that sense. Almost your classic woke liberal, like climate change and migration and all those things.
Well, I mean, the previous Pope as well spoke about all those things. But I suppose it's a matter of emphasis. I mean, Pope Benedict and John Paul II talked an awful lot, for example, about the right to life and abortion issues. They did speak about the environment. They did speak about immigration. They did speak about the developing world. They went to the developing world a lot. But this particular Pope speaks about them more. And I think the fact that he's Argentinian counts. And in South America, they would tend to be more sceptical of the United States, for example, whereas the previous two popes, Polish and German.
Coming up through that liberation theology kind of thing of the 70s, 80s.
And he's a man, exactly. And, you know, he's a man of his time. So he would have kind of been formed in the 60s, 70s against that kind of a background where there would have been a lot of anti-Americanism and scepticism towards the United States. And I think he's retained that. He tends to be pretty cool towards the United States.
Okay. Isn't that all much more fascinating now than we might have been thinking it was? But we will move on to our own fascinations. And Louise Byrne, housing is our big fascination at the moment. So you picked the interview with Housing Minister James Brown in the Sunday Independent, and indeed it gives it the front page story as well. So tell us about that interview with Niamh Horan.
Yeah, that's right. And I think James Brown perhaps is a person that many listeners to the show probably don't really know. He was kind of visible in the last government in some sense. He was looking after stuff like the gambling regulations, but he's really been thrust into the spotlight now with this huge brief, and as the government says, housing is their number one priority. So Niamh Horan did quite an extensive interview with them, and you know, he's coming in and he's talking about a new body and a new fixer-in-chief who will be tasked with kicking open doors to activate housing delivery. Some might say
Elliot Ness kind of style.
Yeah, some might say that's actually the housing minister's job to go in and to be kicking open doors and delivering housing, but that's by the by, I suppose, and it's part of the strategic housing activation office that was agreed at the Cabinet Subcommittee on Housing on Monday evening. But I think what was quite interesting in that is Niamh Horan was asking Minister Brown, you know, what he's planning on doing, what are his big three priorities, and he was talking about implementing the Planning Act that was brought forward in the last government and, you know, dealing with things like people objecting to housing. He was talking about zoning more land for houses when he was asked, you know, how much land, a hell of a lot, which is not very concrete of an answer. You know, it doesn't really say we need to.
Yeah, no, he mentioned Kildare and Wicklow as places where you couldn't really build as much as you should be allowed to build their zone land.
He did. So, yeah. I mean, he did. But I mean, it's not really, you know, a sizable concrete figure to put on the housing. And he was also talking about youth homelessness, which, as we know, is an issue, and that is kind of a broader issue that needs to look at stuff like addiction and mental health and all these kind of things. But I think what was really interesting And we've seen it over the last couple of weeks, this divide between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael on the issue of housing. Okay. We saw first with the idea of Taoiseach Micheál Martin talking about rent pressure zones. Simon Harris pretty quickly distancing himself from that. But one of the big stories this week was Junior Minister John Cummins of Fine Gael. He's in the Department of Housing, but he was looking at lifting planning permission and putting an exemption in place for log cabins. And quite interestingly, in the Sunday Independent today, Minister Brown saying that we can't of a free-for-all with these cabins, that there's a double-edged sword and we have to proceed with caution. And I think one question that he did answer,
he mentions,
which I think
real challenges around wastewater and parking.
Which anyone who lives like I do in a housing estate knows what an issue parking suddenly becomes when there's a load of visitors or anything like that and you're bringing more people into a small area. But I think what
so
was
before I go to Louise Bayliss on this, so are you suggesting that there's a question here that because this was a Fine Gael kite that Fianna Fáil are feeling the need to kind of oppose it or not let Fine Gael have any kind of win here?
They're certainly putting a dampener on it, I think it's fair to say. And I mean, John Cummins during the week had great success. It was at the front page of a number of papers, featured in a number of other papers then
and
during
the week.
And
you would almost suggest that many people might not have known who the Junior Minister for Housing was before that happened.
Perhaps. And I mean, John Cummins was a senator up until recently and he became a TD and then was very quickly put into housing. Now, he was on the housing committee. He was very vocal on housing for Fine Gael in the last government. But perhaps, again, not a person that a lot of people would have known. So I think it's interesting. And Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil for the last kind of fortnight to 3 weeks seem to have been on a collision course on housing and seeming to be wanting to make their own very distinctive marks. But I think what we have to remember is they're in coalition here together and there can't be sniping about each other in the background. Like, they have to be on the one page because it's just unprofessional if they're not, and I think that's what we've seen over the last few weeks.
Okay, Louise Bayliss, you were reading that interview as well. Just a simple question first, and look, you've been around housing in various guises and various of your jobs and everything. What's your gut reaction to the cabins in the garden?
I suppose we're in a crisis and we need solutions. I don't think it should be a long-term solution, but I think it's slightly pragmatic. And at the moment, everything that should be thrown on the table should be put there just so that we can start evaluating and look at things. If we keep where we're going to continue on this. I think there are times where it has made sense for people to have that, but I think the clear message would be that it is for family members only and that there's enough infrastructure before, you know, in the area that it's put in. Exactly like Louise has said about not being over parking or sewerage or any of those type of things. It should never be allowed to be rented out. The idea that, and that would be my fear, that it will, like prefabs in schools, that it becomes nearly a permanent solution, and that what you'll see is it being used for HAP and rented out for HAP, and who will get that will be lower income families such as lone parent households or, you know, single adults, and that would be disastrous.
Okay, so you need to be very firm boundaries.
Very firm.
Graham, the last time you were telling us about when you lived in LA has been one of the examples given this week as to where there's a lot of this kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, LA has a huge housing crisis. And what's great about LA is you have these enormous mansions, which we tend to focus on, but also really small houses, you know, 50 square meter, 60 square meter houses, which, you know, is a normal piece of housing stock. But yeah, people have bigger gardens. They have all sorts of different solutions in their gardens. I think, although I'd never had to engage with the planning much in LA, I was living in someone's garage when I was living there for a summer, one of the summers I lived there. And I don't know what the legal basis of that was. It was very much like living in a converted garage. I think there as here, you know, the planning rules are often there for a reason. I think one of the other concerns about the garden shed was fire. You know, do fire tenders, you know, do they have access to it? Will they, you know that there are people in there if there's a fire? I think another planning regulation, which is there for a reason, is the regulation of Airbnbs. And if we really wanted to bring a lot of properties on stream, we just enforce the existing regulations surrounding Airbnbs, which would drastically limit the number of those on the market. Because most, for the most part, people who are Airbnb hosts aren't living in the actual apartment or house. And so, you know, can only let it out a little bit, and it might incentivize people to make them available to proper renters.
I did a story on this a couple of weeks ago, and there was something like 16 times more properties available to rent short term on the likes of Airbnb and Booking.com and other platforms. There's a few of them than there were on the likes of your daft.ie and
MyHome.ie. Am I right in thinking they are like moving towards action on this? I think Minister for Enterprise Peter Burke is talking in the papers today about tackling this issue again.
Yeah, he had an interview in the Sunday Times today with Claire Scott, and he did say it was something that would be looked at. But this is something that the previous government was looking at. It was held up. Catherine Martin was looking at it, but it was held up because of issues with the European Commission. But it seems to be back on the agenda now. And again, it was something that was agreed to at that cabinet subcommittee on housing on Monday evening. But it seems to have been something that has been put on the long finger. And I think at the time it was launched, the government said it could bring 12,000 homes back into the private rental market if there was a crackdown on this. So,
how would you feel as a young person about living in a cabin in your parents' garden or a relative's garden as a stopgap measure for a short time? I suppose I'm thinking, as all us old people say, we remember living like in Rathmines, South Circular Road, in, you know, kind of the whole bedsit situation, which was by no ways ideal, like, but it's a particular point in your life as well, kind of where you're kind of okay with that for a while, maybe.
I know people who kind of live in this kind of cabin style on
their
parents. Yeah, and like it works really well, and they're very happy to be there and consider themselves very fortunate to be there. I suppose as well, it kind of depends on the house that you're living in, the amount of land that you have. Like when I think of my mother's home, if I was to put one of these in the back garden, I think Minister Cummins was talking during the week about, you know, increased independence, increased privacy. Like if I put this in my man's back garden, like I'd be looked at just as much, you know, that kind of way. So I think it depends on the situation that you're in. I mean, it's not ideal, but I think it's certainly a stopgap, and I think something that a lot of people would be interested in. And there was a piece in the Mail on Sunday today, and it was talking about different providers of these cabins or huts or whatever we want to call them. And the interest, since this was announced on Wednesday, has gone through the roof. I think one person was talking about a 200% increase in the amount of people contacting them.
Imagine,
for these. So
yeah.
It definitely
now,
we
had Kieran McCarthy, you know, the engineer from the what's that TV show, Irish Homes, Small Irish Homes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He basically ended up saying, if you want to do this properly and there's foundations and everything involved and you want to have a nice, livable, comfortable home, that it's 80 or 90 grand rather than, like, you know, I think people were thinking you buy something for 30 grand and stick it in the garden. David Quinn, are you seeing anything hopeful across the minister's interview or housing coverage today?
Well, I mean, it just strikes me that the fact we're talking about modular homes and people's back gardens shows how kind of desperate we're getting for solutions to the problem. I mean, what stands out for me is what always stands out in these interviews about the housing problem, which is huge delays in planning. And that seems to be one of these things that we just don't seem to be able to solve. I mean, it was just shocking that last year we didn't even meet the relatively modest housing target that we had set for ourselves, never mind the huge housing targets we're going to need in the years ahead. Because I think he's saying in the interview, this is James Brown, that we need 300,000 homes by the end of the decade, which could easily not happen. So therefore, the housing crisis gets worse. Population, of course, is increasing very fast, which obviously adds to the problem. So, and then, you know, there's a shortage of building material, there's a shortage of builders, the cost of everything is going up. This is something that is not just an Irish problem. You know, as Graham was saying, there's a big problem in LA as well. There seems to be a big problem in all major cities. And it's one of these things that doesn't seem to have any really easy answer, and I certainly don't have any easy answers to it either. I mean, it's easy for us to complain about it and to talk about the difficulties in meeting the housing targets, but I'm not seeing parts of the world where it's getting readily solved.
Yeah, there are various solutions
Finland
around the world.
Finland has practically ended homelessness, so that there are solutions out there.
Louise, and did you...
What would
Louise
consist of here, though?
Well, there would be loads of things. Like, well, what we have to
did
say...
Did you look
is,
at that Ón O'Malley piece, Louise?
I did,
the,
actually.
Yeah, and it's an interesting one.
No, I actually did read it, and I thought Ón O'Malley, I thought, has offered a solution.
And
he's talked.
So what's he saying? Just
well, what he's saying
people.
Is he brought back to Gardner, Lord Gardner, who at the time, back in whatever 17th century or 18th century, was renovating North Dublin. And he gave it, he was like a coordinator of housing. And he didn't put in all the investment himself, but he did kind of regulate and control it and really encourage people to invest in it. And it led to an upsurge in the area in north from Mountjoy Square to Parnell Square to Gardiner Street. And it was a really thriving area. And he talked about not having the money to himself to put in, but encouraging others to do it.
And he calls it the government's power of coordination.
The power of coordination.
And refers to the Docklands as an example.
It's a solution. And David did say there, like, we can complain, and that's true. So it is good. Whenever I see a solution, I do think, don't knock it till we have a proper analysis and a look at it. But I will say one thing that I did find from the article, there wasn't enough urgency. There didn't seem to be enough real solutions. And I'm looking at, like, the Programme for Government, for instance, says, you know, they're recommitting to the Lisbon Treaty, which was signed back in 2021, and that was to end homelessness by 2030. Since that has happened, since they've signed that, there's been an increase of homelessness by 7,208. Of that, 2,427 are single adults, and the vast majority, 4,781, are people in families. Yet, if you look at the Housing for All strategy document, which is our leading document on homelessness and housing, there's no mention of family homelessness strategy. And it was good to see youth homelessness strategy being mentioned by James Brown. But what is he doing about family homelessness when we know that's the key driver of homelessness?
And briefly, before we leave this as well, you wanted to mention Ona Brinchin, Fane's housing spokesperson, has a piece in the Sunday Independent.
Yes, Ona Breen has a piece in the Sunday Independent, and he talks about this revised estimates for public service in 2025. He, whatever you say about Ona, he's forensic about what he does around housing and homelessness and what he's analysing. And he looked at this 229-page document, and on page 159, he claims that there's a cutback on the money being allocated towards social housing and rent, affordable rents. And he's claiming that's 662 million. So while James Brown in his article talks about 450 million being approved,
this is new money for new money.
In the article, James Brown talks about 450 million being assigned for 3,000 social housing. But if we're actually losing 662 million, that's very worrying at a time of massive crisis.
Yeah, and look, now we don't know what we have asked the department about what that is about, and like, you'd wonder, is it something that they put in, like, you know, the way they put in extra money?
Yeah,
into
it'll be good to see, but it's a good thing.
But anyway,
I just wanted to say something else as well, because I talk a lot about the homelessness, and the homelessness isn't it is the most acute form of housing, but housing crisis is impacting much, and much of our reliance on the private rental sector has caused massive problems for people who are on low incomes, as we all know. And many people think that because you're getting HAP, like housing assistance payment or rent supplement, you're actually better off. But the EU Silk report that comes out every year, which is the survey on income and living conditions, it outlines, you know, what people are experiencing in poverty. So overall in the country, 10.6% of us are at risk of poverty. And when you include housing costs, after housing costs, that goes from 10.6 to 17.9%. For people who are on HAP or getting some type of rent support, they start off at risk poverty of 12%. After they pay their housing costs, that shoots up to 58.6%. So there are people who are housed but in deep poverty because of the housing crisis. So I think we need to remember that as well when we talk about it.
Absolutely. Louise Byrne, this poll in the Business Post. Mm. So explain what they mean by their front page.
Yeah,
that 25% of Fianna Fáil voters say they would vote differently if they'd known about the real housing figures last year.
So in the run-up to the general election, the government were saying that they believed there were going to be 40,000 homes built in 2024. And this was a figure that was being mentioned all the time during the election campaign. And that was based on a lot of different figures, it would appear. It was based on commencement notices that have been put in. It had been based on projections from a lot of independent bodies such as Deutsche Bank, such as Cairn Homes. Now, the CSO, it's worth mentioning, had warned pretty early in kind of just before the election campaign kicked off, that they didn't believe the government was going to hit its actual housing target, which was 30,000 and 33,000 rather, and that it certainly wasn't going to hit the 40,000. But this seems to have kind of been ignored in some senses by the government, who continued to say that they believed they were going to have 40,000 homes. And it only really came out in early January, when the election was over, when the government was in the process of being formed, that it was 30,300 homes were built last year, which is not only below 40,000, but it's below target of 33,000. And this poll in the Business Post is actually, it's quite interesting. So it's a quarter of Fianna Fáil voters said that they would not have voted for the party if they had known that that 40,000 figure wasn't going to be hit. And 18% of Fine Gael voters said the same. And then what I also found interesting was that amongst 18 to 24 year olds, more than 40% of them said that they wouldn't have voted for either Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil if they had known that that 40,000 was going to be hit. And I was quite surprised by it this morning, to be perfectly honest.
I'm more surprised when you look at then the party standings in the poll, because Fianna Fáil is down 2 for sure. At 20%.
So it's not down a quarter.
Okay. And just to give you the rest of them, Sinn Féin is up 1 to 23%. So it's currently ahead of Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. Fine Gael is at 20%, stable since the last poll. Fianna Fáil, as I say, down to 20%, into same at 4%. Greens, no change, 3%. People Before Profit Solidarity plus 1 to 3%. Independents down 2 to 11%. Sock Dems level at 7%. Independent Ireland up 1 at 4%, and Labour up 1 at 4%. And that Red Sea interviewed a random sample of 1,029 adults aged 18 plus online between 14th and 19th of February 2025. And I think they, in the Business Post, it's usually a margin of error or plus or minus 3%. So all of that is within the margin of error. And I would point out as well that the actual sample size for the Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael voters is 363, because obviously they were a subset of the full amount there.
I think it would have been interesting to find out who they would have voted for instead of Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil, because that doesn't seem to have been the information put in the piece. It may not have been one of the questions that was asked, but you know, would people who voted for Fine Gael have voted for Sinn Féin? Realistically, probably not. I wouldn't have thought that anybody voting for Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael would have, you know, been people who would have thought either party could solve the housing crisis. I think I would have thought that people who were worried about the housing crisis and the homelessness figures and the cost of houses and the cost of rents may have voted for someone else. So I think that's interesting in and of itself. But I do think, and this question has arisen and it arose, I suppose, in the aftermath of the general election, of what other alternative did people think they had, or people think that clearly wasn't there for people. So I think it would have been interesting to see who these people would have voted for.
I think when people answer questions in opinion polls, they often answer simply the question in front of them. So they're saying, would you have changed your vote had you known that the housing target wasn't going to be met? It's a bit like if a person is asked, do you want tax cuts? They will say yes. And if the next question is, do you want increased public spending? They will also say yes. So I think there's an element of that.
So it suggests perhaps that that 25% of Fianna Fáil voters are annoyed about it.
But it's only a 2% drop in support for.
I wonder, with the question when they said, would you have voted for them? It doesn't necessarily say they gave them a number one vote. They might have just given them a number two, that's or number three, or number four. So that's why it's not reflecting, that 2% is not reflecting the 25%.
You should be a pollster. That's a very sophisticated an analysis of things. Okay, we'll take a break. Louise Byrne, David Quinn, Dr. Graham Finlay, and Louise Bale is staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us. Louise Byrne, David Quinn, Dr. Graham Finlay, and Louise Bale. Graham Finlay, would you tell us first, the papers haven't got this because nobody can keep up with America right now. Elon Musk sent an email last night, or announced he was sending an email.
He announced that there was going to be an email.
Okay.
Because as per Donald Trump's claim about, you know, getting workers to prove what they do, he says there's going to be an email where you have to tell us what you achieved last week. And if you don't respond, we'll assume that you've resigned. I mean, I'm paraphrasing.
Okay. This is right across the public service in America.
2.4 million federal workers. Yeah. So It's typical of the, I'm not hesitant to call it a management style of Elon Musk when it comes to the Department of Government Efficiency, which is, as people have said, just taking a meat axe, and I actually don't know what you would use a meat axe for, but I want one now, to the federal government.
Yeah. I think a chainsaw is his preferred metaphor.
Yeah, no, he's moved on to the meat chainsaw, but it's, you know, it's just firing people as if there are no regulations, no planning, as if they're all useless, and then making them make a case to come back. It's been typical of the whole approach where they fire the people in charge of America's nuclear stockpile, and then they say, oh, wait, maybe we need those people, and then hire them back. You know, it's chaos, and it's deliberate chaos. I mean, we heard about Project 2025 and it was downplayed during the election campaign, but this is the traumatizing of federal workers that was promised in Project 2025, and it's deeply destabilizing.
David Quinn, any thoughts on it?
I mean, I suppose when Musk came into Twitter, what did he do? He sacked 90% of the staff, and then he comes back and says it didn't affect efficiency all that much, and people were predicting at the time the total collapse of Twitter, that it would come offline and all the rest of it. So he just goes in as a private enterprise guy, and we're going to run this in the most lean possible way, and he's convinced that there's tons and tons of surplus staff in the public service. I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, it could well be. 2.4 million is a lot of people. So he's kind of going for the absolute maximum approach. He knows perfectly well that they won't get too many resignations out of it, but he's probably in practice thinking if we manage to trim the staff by 10%, we'll aim for 50%, we'll end up with 10%. That's still a result, and it does begin to save the public money. And he's thinking it probably won't affect efficiency, because it didn't affect efficiency in Twitter when I get rid of 90%. So I'd imagine that's more or less the way he's thinking.
Yeah. Musk says he laid off 80% of Twitter's
80%,
staff.
80%, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. A lot, anyway.
Yeah, it still seems to be limping along on the 20%. Okay, Graham, if we take the broader issues that are maybe more relevant to us. So we were talking here last week about, the Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessant, arrived in Ukraine apparently last weekend with a contract. We're now told he didn't even want Zelensky to read it. He just said, sign this, right? And again, it could be like, as David says, come in with the maximalist approach and then see where you get. So this is about the, which has become the story now of, and in a way, like, it's pivoted away from the Russia-America relationship. We're now looking at the America-Ukraine relationship potentially being maybe not what we thought it might be, which was nothing. Bessant has a piece in the FT that just went up last night where he's presenting this as almost a kind of a Marshall Plan for Ukraine. There's a part of me thinking, is this crackers? No, you can tell me. Is there a deal to be done here, right? And is this what Trump is about? Trump's not an ideological animal when it comes down to it, right? If there's a deal, even if there isn't like 500 billion or whatever of rare earths there that can be easily extracted. But if Trump can go back to America clutching this, could Ukraine suddenly become his best buddies again? And then he'll get the knock-on effect, presumably. I've heard it said that one of the reasons he might want the war to end is gas prices in America are then maybe halved by the time he's going back before the electorate in 2 years. So is he just looking for financial wins here? And could Ukraine, are they cute enough to capitalize on that?
Well, there's just a lot going on. I mean, you've got Scott Bessent, like a lot of the senior members of the administration, trying to rationalize what looks overtly crazy and a complete stabbing in the back of what was previously a key ally.
But they say watch what he does, not what he says. So if we watch what they're doing, does it tell a different story at all? Or am I being hopelessly naive?
So I don't think you're being hopelessly naive. I mean, what we're seeing charitably is Trump doing the negotiations with Ukraine first before he does the negotiations with Russia. Now, I'm not sure this is the best way to negotiate, but I didn't write the art of the deal. So this particular contract is crazy. As Barry O'Halloran points out in the Sunday Independent, Ukraine doesn't have a lot of rare earths to sell them. A lot of the mineral resources, which they do have, are in the Donbass in Russian-controlled territory. And one of the interesting wrinkles of this deal is 50% of their revenues should go to this fund, which Scott Bessent is saying, oh, we'll use it. We'll control it completely. Sorry. You know, but we're going to use it to reconstruct Ukraine, and it's going to give the U.S. a vital interest in keeping Ukraine as an independent country. Now, it's not a security guarantee. It's just relying on the self-interest of the United States. But it has to get up to $500 billion, as you said, before you know, Ukraine starts to sort of row back on some of that revenue. The revenue from, so it's 50% of revenues from current Ukraine and 66% of any recaptured territory from the Russians, which is where all the minerals are. So it's a terrible deal. Ukraine's revenues are...
It's a terrible deal now, but, yeah. but Ukraine presumably will negotiate and they seem minded to do the deal here, aren't they?
Yes.
If the right deal is there and it gets them what they need, which is protection from the Americans.
They don't have much of a choice. So 50% of Ukraine's 1.1 billion revenues from minerals is $500 million roughly. So that's 1,000 years of mineral revenues to get to the 500 billion. Ukraine is probably prepared to wait a few years to see if somebody who isn't going to extort them is going to be in office, right? And in the meantime, they're trying to get back on Donald Trump's good side so he can then move and negotiate with Russia.
And do you think, is Trump shifting over to being, are the administration shifting over to being slightly friendlier to Ukraine as the week goes on?
It just keeps shifting. And I think what it's the bigger problem is the U.S. just doesn't have allies anymore. It only has vassals. And that's true of Canada. That's true of Ukraine. It's part of the bigger package, which is good old-fashioned imperialism, where the great powers just carve up parts of the world and demand Greenland from people and sell parts of territories with actual people living on them to each other and go to weaker states and just say, right, give us your minerals.
The other side of being a vassal is you enjoy the protection of your lord as well, and they do want the protection of their lord in this situation.
So we'll have to come up with that. Well, actually, there is a word for this. They're not going to get the protection, but they might get the vassalage, right?
Okay. David, to bring it home slightly more, you picked Shane Ross in the Sunday Independent. Trump's reckless rampage leaves Ireland flat-footed.
Yeah, well, he's talking in particular about defence spending. And in fact, I mean, that's a very dominant theme among the opinion writers in the papers today. There's about five or six or seven across the papers talking about this. Do you mind if I just chip in a little bit about Ukraine?
Yeah.
Because you can't have the war going on and on and on and on in the current stalemate and hundreds of thousands dying until whenever, because both sides are looking for total victory. I mean, I think that Ukraine needs less. I'm thinking here about the Irish Civil War and the treaty. We need a bit of a Michael Collins figure in Ukraine who's willing to say, we're not going to win total victory here. We do need to bring this thing to a halt. We can't keep having our people bleeding dry. So we got to stop it. And that will mean a compromise. And the same thing happened, by the way, in the Korean War. In fact, in the Korean War, it's interesting. In 1953, in comes Ike Eisenhower, and he says, this thing has got to end. It could go on and on and on and on. Because it dragged on for 3 years. Unbelievable numbers of people died. Eisenhower signed a deal directly over the head of the South Korean leader, because the South Korean leader was not willing to sign because he would get in trouble with his own people for not demanding total reunification of the whole Korean peninsula. And so Eisenhower said, that's totally unrealistic. We're signing a deal with the Chinese. We're signing a deal with Kim Il-sung, the leader of North Korea at that time. And the South Korean leader refused to sign it. And I would say he was probably quietly relieved that the war had come to an end. So you have Zelensky, who might feel trapped by his own people into not signing a deal, and Trump comes in and says, well, we're going to get a deal like in Korea and end this war, and Zelensky will be quietly relieved that it has come to an end.
Is there any chance that that's the case?
Well, I mean, I think there is something to that. Zelensky's in a really terrible bind. And what's more interesting, I think, on this front, which backs David up, is if you ask, as soon as they talked about a deal with Russia, you talk to Ukrainians in Ireland, and they were worried about a civil war between the people who cannot accept giving away territory and the people who just want peace. And
like what happened here in Ireland.
Exactly.
Yeah. Interesting you mentioned Korea. There was a deal floating around under the Biden administration, the heads of a deal, that would involve a DMZ and where the borders would not actually be agreed. It would be kicked down the road, wasn't it? So that no border would be set in stone, so that maybe there wouldn't be a civil war about it.
And we've had Cyprus for decades, you know.
Louise Bayliss, just to bring this back down to earth, because I think this was a really striking piece that you picked, which is Fegan's piece from Irpin in Ukraine. Tell us about that. And we all remember Irpin, don't we, as one of those suburbs
of
Kyiv.
That was so close to Kyiv.
Battle,
and it's she went into a kindergarten with children aged 2 to 6, and she witnessed it. Firstly, she spoke about the resilience of the kindergarten principal and the assistant principal and the whole community, that they rebuilt the kindergarten after it was made unsafe by bombing and whatever, and that the children are now back in the kindergarten. And she talked about the, you know, the air sirens going off at least twice a day, and the children knowing the routine and going downstairs into the bomb, into their shelter, and normalising that. And that's the reality of what they're going through at the moment and living through that. And you think about the trauma of children. And for some reason, it struck me about, do you remember when we were in COVID? I know nobody wants to go back there, but in that time in COVID, and there were little toddlers who hadn't seen nothing else but COVID, and they used to go into shops and they'd see a thing and they'd go to wash their hands because it became so normalised. And I thought of those children, and that was bad enough to see children that normalised, but to think of children in a war-torn country going down to bomb shelter and knowing how to react in a bomb shelter, it's not what anybody should see in the world. And I think
that's a very striking line of a woman from, I think, Zaporizhia or somewhere more in the east, saying, well, look, at least around here the alarm goes off and then the bombs come. Yeah. Whereas like where I come from, the bombs come and then the alarm goes off.
Yeah, and I do think it's an important piece, because I think what we see at the moment is there's starting to creep an anti-Ukraine sentiment coming into the country, that it's safe and they should just go back and we've done our bit. And I think it's important that articles like this highlight what's going on.
So Louise Byrne, bring us back home then. The defence spending and triple lock and all of that. This debate now is really mainstreamed, isn't it, in Ireland?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you heard Jennifer Carroll McNeill, who is the health minister now, but in the previous government, she was a minister of state in the Department of Defence. And she was saying during the week that, you know, we need to really double our defence spending. And there's a really actually
to a staggering 0.4%, like, which 0.4%. Would probably still mean
and we've the lowest in the European Union. Most people's defence spending is around, you know, 2, maybe 4%. So we are really behind. And there's an interesting kind of infographic on page 6 and 7 of the Mail on Sunday that talks about what we have, what we don't have. Like, we have no primary radar, all these kind of things. So that it's worth a look at. But I guess the most pressing or the most imminent change, I think, will be this triple lock that's coming down the line. Currently, the system we have in place is, if the government wants to send more than 12 defence force personnel away on a peacekeeping mission, it has to go through this triple lock. So that's government approval, Oireachtas approval, Dáil approval, and then a UN mandate. And I think there's been growing concern recently over the need for that UN mandate, and that's primarily around the members of the permanent UN
security.
Because you have the likes of Russia there, you've like the likes of China.
They have a veto.
Yeah, and if they veto, Ireland wouldn't be able to send their troops on peacekeeping missions. So what Taoiseach Simon Harris is saying, and of course he's also the Foreign Affairs and a Defence Minister, and what he's saying is that he wants to look at the removal of that UN requirement. And I think what he was really keen to stress, and I think this is an element of this debate that really does concern people, is what the effect of this would be on Irish neutrality. Because I think neutrality is something that people hold in this country very dear. It's something that people would not like to see eroded. And what he was saying is that it would not.
Yeah, some people disagree on it, but yeah.
Some people disagree, but I think I would think, and I think looking at the debate in the Dáil, I think it's the one thing that the whole opposition and the government seem to be united on, this fact that we want to keep our military neutrality. And what Simon Harris is saying is that this would not affect it. But I guess there have been issues where this has come up in the past, the fact you couldn't send more than 12 Defence Forces members. There have been issues where there have been people stranded abroad, where we have had to call in the likes of the French, always seem to be digging us out of holes. So I think it's something that is going to be looked at, it's something that's going to be debated, and I think this is going to be a hot topic and something that people will not agree on.
Yeah, the thing is, though, I was just thinking, David Quinn, I was going to say there would have been like proverbial war if this was mentioned before, but he seems to be throwing it out today to all the papers as almost this is just something we're going to do. And there hasn't been, I don't know, the world hasn't ended yet. Has everything changed around all of this with the events of the last one?
I think the answer is yes. And it seems to be by and large because of Trump coming along and saying you've all got to increase your defence spending because you're going to be on your own possibly soon. And then, like these other European countries, look at Ireland and they say, how much are you spending on defence? 0.2%. That's absolutely pathetic. It's about a tenth of the average. So even if we double it, as you say, it's only 0.4%. So we're very much exposed as having no clothes. And then even what we do like to do, which is send in UN peacekeepers, as Louise is saying, that can be vetoed at the UN Security Council. And so they want to stop that happening. And as you say, Brendan, he's suddenly talking about this. And I think there's a bit of realism beginning to dawn that we can't have it absolutely every which way. I mean, we can be neutral, but the UN doesn't have to have a veto, the Security Council, over what we do. And if we want to be credibly neutral, assuming we do want to be neutral, we can spend essentially nothing on our defence. We don't even seem to have the capacity to send decent drones up into the seas to keep an eye on what's going on. If we can't send out boats because we don't have enough personnel, then where are the drones,
we seem to have
which are
one,
long range?
Like it's been quoted a lot this week that there is one boat that can go out at the moment and it doesn't have a working gun because there's nobody to fix the gun. Graham, what do you make of it?
Well, I think he is trying to cozy up to Donald Trump, although Donald Trump's fixation on Ireland is very much about the balance of trade and not about our non-existent support for our own defense. I mean, obviously, there's a great opportunity to increase our spending on the defense forces just by paying them decently and supporting the actual technology to be effective protectors of our own seas and air. Now, I've been in this country 25 years. I didn't grow up here. I don't have the visceral attachment to neutrality that people of my political persuasion probably do. But I do know, having been here a long time, that the Irish government doesn't like paying for stuff. And so if the RAF is going to police our skies, you know, well, that's okay. Yeah. So I'm not expecting a huge contribution. But what we will see is, I think it's a test for Ireland, which has performed in common security and defense policy missions more than some people would like. But the EU is about to be tested, possibly, or quite likely, as a defense alliance, a defensive alliance, which is in the treaties. And Ireland has a bit of an opt-out. But I don't know if the European Union, let alone Ireland, is going to rise to the occasion should we be left on our own to try and prosecute, among other things, the Ukrainian war, where the Americans have taken their ball and gone home.
Yeah, and like there isn't even a defense industry here either. Even if people did want up their spending and buy stuff, they're buying it from America.
Some people are very exercised about it. I think Raytheon is a big player in Northern Ireland. But in the Republic of Ireland, I don't think there is much of a defence industry, no.
Okay, just quickly before we go to a break, Louise, where is the thinking at in Leinster House about the visit to Washington on St. Patrick's Day?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Sinn Féin obviously made a significant announcement on Friday that they would not be going. Mary Lou McDonald and Michelle O'Neill would not be going. Now, people pointing out they hadn't yet been invited, I think it was imminent that they were to be invited. But they are supporting the Taoiseach going, and they are very much in the minority on that. The other opposition parties, the Labour Party, have called for him to rethink going. The Soc Dems have said he shouldn't go. People before profit never think he should go. So that, I guess that's
what's left.
Is anyone
getting
surprise.
Windy about whether it is actually going to happen? Or
no, I think they're quietly confident enough, and I think there's been a lot of questions about, you know, invitations issuing, but my understanding of it is there is a lot of communication back and forth, and this is predominantly done through embassies both in America and here. I think they are fairly confident that this will go ahead, but it'll be an interesting to see what happens in the next 3 weeks before he actually finally makes it there.
Yeah, okay. Louise Byrne, David Quinn, Dr. Graham Finlay and Louise Bale is staying with us. We'll take a quick break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. We just have a couple of minutes. Louise Bayliss, you wanted to mention a piece by Gráinne Nié in the Sunday Times, parents to stage a 24-hour protest over lack of special school places.
Yeah, I think this has been a recurring theme, but it's really a huge breach of these children's rights. And there's the fact that this woman, Charlotte Cahill, has organised this sleep out for 24 hours for her child, has been in preschool for the last 3 years because she can't get a place, and she's worried that what will happen in September if she doesn't get a place. I mean, there should be a place, a school place for every child in the country. And she made a very good point, and I thought it was really heartbreaking when she said, why do we always have to expose our vulnerabilities to get the state to act? And I think that's true, and it happens in so many different places where people are victims. They need to get the public support by sharing the vulnerabilities of her child. And I think it's, we're in a wealthy country, 50 children without school places coming up to September. Something needs to be done, and my support goes out to those families. but obviously feel very angry that they feel obliged to camp outside the Dáil for 24 hours.
Okay. Graham, before we go, you have about 30 seconds. As a proud Canadian, I gather there's a huge upswing of Canadianness going on.
Yeah, it was very un-Canadian for us to boo the American national anthem at a hockey game. And, yeah. and then there were an extra level of fighting, which is an integral part of ice hockey in Canada.
It was a proxy war, basically, yeah, that ice hockey match.
It was a war on the ice, you know.
And apparently tens of millions of viewers.
Yeah, but I mean, there's been a real surge in Canadian patriotism of an almost un-Canadian sort, except that the most Canadian thing is to be annoyed at the United States because everything they do affects us 10 times as much. So, you know, it's not unlike Ireland and the United Kingdom. You know, I think it was Pierre Trudeau, okay. Justin's father said, if the U.S. sneezes, we catch a cold. But even our populist right-wing conservative candidate for prime minister has had to sort of succumb to the anti-American fervor.
Okay, so you're enjoying yourselves is what you're saying in short. Okay, thanks very much to our panel today, Louise Byrne, David Quinn, Dr. Graham Finlay and Louise Bayliss. And now it's just coming up to 12 noon and we'll go to the newsroom and Helen Donoghue.